listening to CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.
The following is an encore presentation from CKUW's archives. Join us next week when the regular host will be back with a few new episodes of original programming.
Welcome back to Ronnie's Reckless Reviews. Today I got some horror movies on the docket. First up, a movie I've been meaning to see, Smile 2. I was going to review this movie a couple months ago, but I couldn't. I had the movie tickets ready to go, but once we got to the booth, they asked for our IDs because apparently Smile 2 is 18A. I've seen several horror movies in theaters, and apparently Smile 2 is the limit, the scariest horror movie of all time. Anyway, we scrambled and ended up buying tickets for Heretic, which was playing on the same time slot, and it was quite good. It really shows off Hugh Grant's acting in a major way after his disappointing performance in Wonka. The story was very engaging, and the technical aspects were all top-notch. I'd give Heretic an 8 out of 10. But anyways, the movie I actually wanted to watch at the theaters, I finally managed to watch at home just recently. The first Smile was very, very bad, and I was expecting the same thing from this movie. There was a bit of a fan base for the first movie because from what I remember, the subtext and themes weren't handled too poorly, but I just could not take it seriously at all because the horror aspects were very laughable and terribly cliche. A 3 out of 10 movie. I'm pleased to say that somehow they got it right for the sequel. It was a vast improvement on the first movie, aside from a few scenes. The movie was genuinely, viscerally disturbing at times, so I can't complain too much that the Canadian rating system was trying to protect me. I could actually take the subtext and theme seriously when everything was presented so much more competently. There was a key scene where the main character sees several smiling people, the gimmick of the series, crawling towards her like a horde of bugs, and it was insanely well choreographed and put together, and demonstrated perfectly the themes of the paranoia that comes with having a drug addiction while being a pop star, and feeling like everyone is invading your privacy at all times. One of the best horror sequences of the year. I thought the main actor, Naomi Scott, was incredible. The cinematography was very impressive. The entire cold open is shot as if it's a one-take scene, and it's one of the best cold opens of the year. The music was incredible. Other movies like Sorry to Bother You and They Clone Tyrone have done similar stylistically wonky scores in recent years, but this one was just as effective as those two for me. Almost all the effects and ideas for the horror set pieces were very well done. Later in the movie, there were scenes like a flashback scene that takes place in a car that reminded me of an arcade dinosaur 3D game that kind of took me out of it. I was a bit disappointed that the polish faltered in some of the later scenes, but it was only a few select cases. There was also some jump scares later on where the characters' voices were supposed to be all demonic, and it felt like the horror was reverting back to the level of the first one. But it never fully pulled me out of the movie. Overall, this was one of the biggest horror franchise glow-ups that I've seen ever, from the first movie to the second, and I would give Smile 2 an 8 out of 10. Speaking of smiles, here's a movie that I wasn't smiling through. Trap. Another movie featuring a prominent pop star character, directed by M. Night Shyamalan. This is better than his previous work, Knock at the Cabin, but not by much. I will say, just as Dave Bautista is amazing in Knock at the Cabin, Josh Hartnett really pulled through and saved this movie from not being fun at all. His performance was incredibly enthralling and enjoyable. He was very convincingly goofy, yet slightly creepy, and he was easily the best part of the movie. The other two main characters are Josh Hartnett's character's daughter, and Lady Raven, a Taylor Swift-esque pop star played by M. Night Shyamalan's daughter, and she is not a good actor at all. It's always tough navigating calling a child actor's performance bad, but it's almost always indicative of a bad director and not really on the child. It's especially obvious when the other child in the movie, Ariel Donahue, is actually really good at acting, because she was hired off of talent instead of nepotism as a scheme to promote his daughter's music career. And nothing against Salika Shyamalan, but her acting is just very bad. Thankfully, Josh Hartnett gets most of the screen time, and he's great. The story, however, was not very good. The plot revolves around Josh Hartnett as a serial killer called The Butcher, who is taking his daughter to a concert of Lady Raven, and while there he finds out that the concert is a trap to find him. Hijinks ensues before The Butcher finds a way to get Lady Raven to pick his daughter to be the dream girl of the show, where Lady Raven picks her to come up on stage so that backstage he can convince her into coming to his house by threatening to remotely kill a prisoner he has locked up if she doesn't let herself go to his house, so he can slip through customs and police surrounding the concert. And I feel like a lot of this would be better for a video game. Like just walking around as a big burly Josh Hartnett looking for clues and ways to escape before switching POV to Lady Raven. Maybe then the bad acting, bad writing, and distracting plot points wouldn't be so annoying. Like, there's a scene where Lady Raven is in the bathroom calling for help at the butcher's house for like 10 minutes as Josh Hartnett bangs on the door, doing nothing to really stop her at all, just screaming on the other end. And all I could think of was, this is such a scene that would be in a video game and maybe make more sense as like a time mission in a video game, instead of a scene in a movie that we're supposed to be engaged with on a genuine level. And maybe all the sections where the butcher receives convenient information from sources he finds just out of random luck wouldn't feel so idiotic if the clues were found through interacting with NPCs in a video game. Very dull story, and some of the character choices and plot points, especially as the movie goes on, are just so stupid and contrived. Still, aside from the many Shyamalan annoyances, a good chunk of this movie is watching Josh Hartnett weaseling around and just acting his ass off, so it's still pretty entertaining. But I would give Trap a 5 out of 10. Speaking of great lead actors, the final movie I'm bringing up is Maxine, starring Mia Goth, the third in the X trilogy, and this one is the worst, but it's still quite good. Each movie in the series is a period piece horror movie homage to past eras of horror, while still being its own unique concept. The first one taking place in the 70s, the second in the late 1910s, and this one in the 80s. Each one is directed by Ty West and stars Mia Goth. X is a very classic raunchy 70s slasher where the killer is an old couple, the main focus being on the old wife, who is also played by Mia Goth, in very heavy makeup. The entire trilogy is about Mia Goth's character's dreams of stardom, and the first one is about Maxine starring in an adult movie, being confronted with this creepy old lady Pearl, who is resentful of Maxine and jealous of her youth. And the second movie, Pearl, is the origin story of the disturbed Pearl as a young girl who also dreams of being a movie star. Pearl is more of a slow psychological movie, and it really shows off how insanely good of an actress Mia Goth is. I would give X an 8 out of 10 and Pearl a 9. Pearl was in my top 10 of 2022. Finally, we arrive at Maxine, with Mia reprising her character from X, moving on from adult content and looking to become the next big movie star. And I did quite enjoy it. Of course, Mia Goth was great. The gore and horror shenanigans were great. I love all the practical effects and death sequences. There's a scene early on showing Maxine to be a badass final girl, involving her stepping on somebody else's lower body part, and it was really brutal and visceral. There's a scene where Maxine is being covered by a clay mold to create a fake head for her, for a movie she's in, and it's very skin-crawling and well-edited, the scene. There's a scene where Maxine's gay best friend is being slashed, intercut with Maxine highlighting text to memorize for a role she booked, and it's a very cool sequence. And the final death scene where she shoots the main villain with a shotgun was simple but very effective. The practical gore was just top-notch all around. I also liked the music for the most part. The wailing brass and soaring electronic guitars were very ear-catching. I didn't really like some of the percussion. I think some of the scenes could have gone with just the eerie brass. The bongos felt weirdly derivative of Doom for a movie trying to evoke 80s music. The technical aspects were consistently great, however the characters and writing weren't amazing. I can't put my finger on it, but the other two in the series do a really seamless job at riding the line between a really good modern horror and a cheesy homage to past eras. And this one just isn't great at it. The cheesy, goofy characters are amazing and entertaining. Bobby Cannavale has a smaller role as a theatrical, gruff police officer, and he's very good. Kevin Bacon was very, very fun to watch with his cartoony southern drawl and outfit, and Simon Prast played the main slasher, being Maxine's priest dad, and he was probably the best part of the whole movie, even if he didn't have that much screen time. The more grounded characters, on the other hand, weren't that great. Maxine herself was kind of annoying. She started off with some really great showcases of her being badass as hell and being very driven and easy to follow, but at some point she just becomes a dumb horror movie character cliche. In some scenes, she barely even tried to escape the person who was trying to kill her and had to be conveniently saved at the last minute, and it was so against her character. The gay best friend was very underdeveloped, and it was so obvious he was going to die. And while his death scene was great, it wasn't as heartbreaking or shocking as the movie seemed to act like it was. And it felt very insulting that they plastered a very in-your-face Coca-Cola ad on the screen right after Maxine broke down crying over his death. In the end, the presentation of this movie was excellent. The acting, directing, and the technical aspects were all really stellar. But I feel they dropped the ball on Maxine's journey slightly. The good definitely outweighed the bad, and I would give this movie a 7 out of 10. All three of these movies have their faults, some more than others. But really, what brings them together are the three incredible lead performances, some of the best I've seen this year, and I hope they get the respect they deserve for their acting. Anyway, that's all I have for you listeners today. Check out Ronnie Reviews on Instagram for more info. And before I let you go, it's time for Ronnie's Joke of the Week. What would you call the star of Maxine if she was soup? Mia Broth. Okay, that was pretty bad. Let me try again. What would you call the star of Spile 2 if she was a horse? Naomi Scott. Okay, one more. What would you call the star of Trap if he was a little gassy? Josh Fartnett. Yeah. See you next time on Ronnie's Repulsive Reviews. Welcome back to Ronnie's Retrograde Reviews. Today I'm talking about an artist who I've quickly become a fan of over the past few weeks, legendary rapper Little Sims. This week I'm going to discuss two of her albums, and the reason I listen to one of them is to prepare to listen to her newest album, which dropped last Friday. And I'm really glad I did. Since last week I reviewed Pink Pantheress's new album, these are back-to-back British black woman reviews. I guess this is needed to happen to balance out my two episodes on Jack Quaid movies, but anyway, I had already been aware of Sims' music. I believe I first heard her back when her song Venom was used in Venom 2 Let There Be Carnage, everybody's favorite movie. So I'd been vaguely aware of her and had semi-positive feelings toward her. Basically, her new album Rollout finally pushed me to actually explore her music. So let's get into it with 2021 album Sometimes I Might Be Introvert. In short, this album blew me away. Immediately I was pumped for her new album Lotus because this LP is near perfect in my eyes. This is a project with a clear vision that came together beautifully with the help of Sims herself, her producer Imflow, and the narrator Emma Corrin. First of all, the album simply sounds amazing. The entire tracklist has a specific style of production, being the lush soul samples inspired by time-tested tenets of classic hip-hop, with a unique flair of an orchestral cinematic quality and a focus on African-inspired drums and voices. I love the repeating theme of children singing in grand choirs to give Simbi's message more weight. I think my favorite piece of production on the album is for the track Two Worlds Apart, because it's maybe my favorite style of hip-hop production in general with the chopping up of soul samples, this one being a sample of Smokey Robinson, who simply has a beautiful voice. And I love how the sample is built upon and shifted, pitched up and down to fit with the specific mood of the lyrics being rapped.
Okay, if you love me, baby, why'd you want to lose me? You use me, confuse me, accuse me, it's truly a movie.
I also really like the simple distorted synth production on Speed.
Influential as fuck, I shouldn't keep my skin. All the sink in my pen is what led me to win.
Not for the beat being revolutionary or anything, but because, despite the sound being quite different from most of the rest of the album, the very end brings it back to that orchestral sound to transition into the next song. Fear No Man is a perfect example of the heavy African inspiration in the roots of the album, with the jungle beat and incredible piano instrumental and great vocal sample for the chorus. I think the greatest feat of production on the album is probably the very first song, though. It's incredibly cinematic and hooks you immediately and intrigues you with the intense, grandiose horns and chanting crowds of war. It's like being in the middle of a climax of a battle scene in some grand epic. It's exhilarating and very well produced and put together. Of course, the production wouldn't come together so well if it weren't for Sims knowing exactly how to guide the trajectory of the production, and how to use the beats to perfection. One of the best examples is what she does on the beat for I Love You, I Hate You, where she uses this very abrasive and hard to rap to vocal chop to talk about her complicated relationship with her father.
You made the promise to God to be there for your kids. You made the promise to give them a life you didn't live. My ego won't fully allow me to say that I miss you, a woman who hasn't confronted all her daddy issues.
This is a continuing theme throughout of her reflecting on how her roots and family have affected her and her current self. On Little Q, she raps in the perspective of her cousin and describes vividly a story of this young boy who had to grow up fast in a broken household before eventually finding himself in serious trouble when he almost dies from a stabbing. But even in such a dire situation, Sims flips it and holds empathy for the stabber, explaining that the boy also grew up in the same broken system of dangerous violent cycles in poor black communities that have been set up and held by people in power.
Changed when I had a brief encounter with death, all the pearly gates open when that knife was in my chest. Not the mental scars, the physicals all you see. But the boy that stabbed me is just as damaged as me.
This is a call to not let these cycles consume us and unify, which harkens back to her lyric on the first track, as long as we're unified, we've already won.
We walk in blind, faith not knowing the outcome, but as long as we're unified, then we've already won.
She also takes time to reflect on her relationship with her sister on the very last verse of the album.
Can't believe the space I'm in with my older sister. I left the global empire and now she thinks I missed her.
She has plenty of moments on the project talking about the industry and people who hurt her in her life, like the very powerful song Standing Ovation, which is Sims' cry to be recognized, as she reflects on her ego and comes to terms with how blessed she is, but how she still does deserve it. Or How Did You Get Here, where instead of rapping about her current career, she looks back on her past and moments of doubt and uncertainty that plagued her high school years, but the passion and spirit that inevitably brought her to her current state of the artist she is.
I think I need a standing ovation. Over 10 years in a game, I'm impatient. Sometimes I sit and I wonder, I'm the version of me I always imagined when I was younger.
But really, the album isn't much about her artistic career, and really just an album about herself. Lots of the album is spent reflecting internally. I mentioned that the production is very cinematic in times, and there's even a running storyline throughout the album. Gems Interludes features a lush soundscape behind a chanting choir of singers encouraging Sims to follow her heart before the narrator comes in to lay down the ropes of fame and guide her through her career.
They won't silence you, but they'll try to. So follow your heart. It'll guide you.
These ideas continue in The Rapper That Came to Tea, where the narrator is warning her that she might not survive or fit in as an introvert in a world of extroverts who just want to be entertained. It's like a representation of her fears and anxiety of pushing forward in this industry in fear of falling back.
Question if I may, what's a girl like you want in a place like this? You see, I've seen many come and go in my lifetime.
There's other interludes as well, but the final important piece of the storyline is the garden. See, in the other two moments I brought up, the narrator refers to Little Sims as Sims, her rapper name, to signify a duality inside her, before the narrator finally steps back and calls her Simbi on this track, her actual name. The album title, Sometimes I Might Be Introvert, is even an acronym for her name, Simbi. It ties into the theme of push and pull of her personal life and career, her family and her business. Sims the artist or Simbi the person?
Sims the artist or Simbi the person?
The Garden is a moment where the narrator essentially lays down the thesis of the album, which is to love yourself and reflect on the hardships in your life and confront yourself in order to find a way to love yourself and tend to your garden, to create and nourish a space to leave room for love and understanding.
Water your seeds. Give your garden the love it needs.
On the track Protect My Energy, Sims takes a break from rapping to lay down some beautiful vocals to create a lush pop jam, to express her values for creating this space, this garden, and protecting it. It's really profound stuff, and it's a wonderful album. My favorite tracks are Two Worlds Apart, Little Q Part 2, Fear No Man, Standing Ovation, and Introvert. And I would give Sometimes I Might Be Introvert a 9 out of 10.
Total silence is my therapy, protecting my energy.
So, hey, you know how I talked about how great the production was on that album? Well, it turns out the man behind the great production isn't quite as great as the production he produced.
Little Sims is suing her former producer Inflow for the recovery of $1.7 million, which the artist claims
You see people getting money, not paying back the money, or people not getting the money they deserve.
But that'll be mentioned later. Anyways, on to her newest album, Lotus. I'm happy to say she didn't let us down. I love the out-of-the-box sound to this album. There's lots of rock influence, there's also still a signature sonic inspiration from Africa that she loved to pull from. The rock inspiration comes through strong on songs like Young, which is essentially a fun and rebellious punk song, and Thief, which has some incredible guitar tones and emotionally intense guitar melodies on the chorus, which also contribute to the darker, spooky tone to the song.
Yeah.
There's also lots of piano-based ballads and somber orchestral sounds harkening back to Sometimes I Might Be Introvert on Blood and Hollow. There's also an unconventional style of drums throughout the album, in the sense that there's lots of moments with minimal or no percussion, especially for a rap album. I like those moments because it makes you listen to the music in a different way, it makes you really take in the lyrics. And the lyrics are great.
One thing you never harbor is hatred. I know the space you're in is sacred.
I also got reminded of One by Ghostface Killah on the end of Free, and I didn't know where to put that anecdote in the review.
Can't hold me down cause I've always been. Why do you always wanna hate when the love is?
How many cakes we bake, y'all?
What?
Yeah. How many L's we smoke?
A lot of this album is continuing the themes brought up from her last album I talked about, with the importance put on self-love, introspection, and growing, hence the title Lotus. But the loudest theme of this album is the sort of sense that this LP was really made to let off a lot of steam, and use her art to express her anger and strong emotions. Lots of this album is focused on her longtime producer Inflow, who she's had a falling out with. I love his production on Sometimes I Might Be Introvert, but despite being talented, he's revealed to be quite the villain on this album, with Sims calling out his abusive behavior and failure to pay her an entire $1 million that he owes her. She spills on one of her most introspective and somber songs, Lonely, that the falling out with Inflow deeply impacted her process for making this album. After working with him for so long, she felt a little lost and lonely making an album on her own, and started doubting her talent. Of course, by the end of the song, she relays how much she needed to make this album, and she reassures herself of her art because she's an inspirational icon.
I was lonely making an album till I realized my story's all I can pour out.
She also strays back to familial themes on the track Blood, where she weaves a story of a brother and a sister reconnecting on an intense phone call. It seems to me like this track might be loosely based on her complicated relationship with her sister that she talks about on Sometimes I Might Be Introvert, and it's a very moving ballad.
But when I hear you talking what you're going through, it breaks my heart into two pieces. It's like life's got two meanings.
Three series and four seasons.
By the end of the album, she wraps up by relaying a message to keep moving and stay strong, but I think my favorite moment on the entire album, and the one I want to end this review on, is on the second verse of the title track Lotus. This song in general is really incredible, and the production is moving and complex, but the writing is the big focus. She lays down her verse in a very intense tone, touching on her anger with people online who complain about how she doesn't talk enough about social issues on social media. She explains how that isn't the way she expresses herself, and turns it back around to the commenters, saying they live their lives on a screen and that she goes out in the real world to preach. But she also ends up landing on her biggest point, which is that she also, which she's been saying for years, believes that self-love and watering your own garden and pushing for growth is what's most important to her. It's angry, it's nasty, it's emotionally intense, and it's beautiful. Favorite tracks are Lotus, Thief, and Lonely, and I would give this album Lotus an 8 out of 10.
You think you're who he feeling?
Anyways, that's all I have for you listeners this week. Check out Review Ronnie on Instagram, and before I let you listeners go, it's time for Ronnie's Joke of the Week. What would you call Little Sims if she was a miniature role-playing video game? Little Sims. See you next time on Ronnie's Raucous Reviews.
Hey, Ronnie.
Good reviews?
Fabulous reviews.
This is Ronnie. Make it good.
Ronnie could have been a
reviewer.
It's Ronnie, all right.
Ronnie
reviews.
Fabulous reviews.
And this is the best review we got.
If you enjoyed that episode and you want to support the station, you should consider donating. From the 6th to the 20th of February, CKUW is holding their annual fun drive. So if you enjoy listening to me talk about art and pop culture, and you want the show to keep striving, you can donate early through fundrive.ckuw.ca. You can get perks and special items depending on how much you want to give. But most importantly, by donating, you're helping out your favorite local radio station and showing your support to the local arts and expression. So if that's something that interests you, go to fundrive.ckuw.ca.
Listener-driven, never corporate program. This is independent radio, CKUW 95.9 FM, Winnipeg.
It's that time of year again. CKW's Fun Drive starts on February the 6th and goes till February the 20th. CKW is a community-focused alternative to mainstream media. We believe in community access to mass media. Every summer, CKW does Radio Camp, a free two-week day camp for kids aged 10 to 17 in Winnipeg's inner city. It is through listener donations that Radio Camp exists. Go to fundrive.ckw.ca to donate.
CKUW 95.9 FM is supported by the Dave Barber Cinematheque, located at 100 Arthur Street. Run by the Winnipeg Film Group, the Dave Barber Cinematheque has been a mainstay in the Exchange District since the 1980s, showing films from across the globe and highlighting Winnipeg filmmakers. Check out their show listings, updated monthly, at DaveBarberCinematheque.com. The Dave Barber Cinematheque, from cult classics to documentaries, from experimental surrealism to captivating realism, you can find a seat and some popcorn at 100 Arthur Street. Check out their show listings, updated monthly, at DaveBarberCinematheque.com. Show your CKUW Friends card and get member pricing for any regular screening.
Shh!